This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about Occupy Wall Street, including a legal update from civil rights attorney Danny Alterman.
An exciting day. First we won in court, then we lost. But the movement continues. We talk about the capitalist crisis, not only in the United States, but Greece and in Europe. We have the star, Rick Wolf, telling us that the debtors are not at fault.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Last Monday, an extraordinary event happened in New York. The mayor and his cops went in and they attempted to destroy Occupied Wall Street. And I know you have a lot of feelings, we all do, about the importance of Occupied Wall Street. And I know you were there that night, actually. But let's talk a little bit about what you think about the importance of Occupied Wall Street.
I think it represents a challenge to the people that own and run this country that's never been marshaled before, not in my lifetime, and I go back to the movement like you do in the 60s, and not in the experience of our parents who were around in the 30s, not in the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, not in anything. This linked up young people, it linked up people of color, it linked up the unions, it linked up everybody, and has the support of the majority of American people, and it was moving in an extremely radical direction, challenging who owns what and how they rule. And that was the threat that was presented. And that's what Bloomberg had to figure out how to contain.
Bloomberg is the mayor of New York.
The billionaire mayor of New York.
And of course, Occupied Wall Street began on September 17th. And November 17th, a few days ago, was the two-month anniversary. And of course, they busted it before the two-month anniversary and before there was going to be mass protests all around the country in honor and in support of Occupied Wall Street. You were there that night, and of course they destroyed the camp physically, but how important do you think that physical space is? And I know this is much debated within the people at Occupied Wall Street, and it's going to be up to them whether they think it's a good idea to try and go reoccupy that site or to occupy other places, whether it's in front of Mayor Bloomberg's house in New York or other parks or whatever. Give me some sense of how important you think today occupying that site is. Certainly back in the early days, this was the center of American capitalism. It sent an incredibly important message about the depredations and the inequality created by Wall Street. But how important do you think it is if they don't get back into that site?
Well, they're not back. They're not going to get back in, not in terms of pitching tents and living there and serving meals. They're out, and they're going to be out for good. That's the import of the judge's decision that we're going to discuss. But how important it is? Well, it's symbolically extremely important. It's at the foot of Wall Street, the symbol of worldwide capitalism. But it's not gone for good. I mean, we all thought it's going to morph, something's going to change. If not now, 2 months from now, when you have zero-degree weather and freezing ice storms, there was a time when it would have to morph. It morphed earlier than we had hoped because of the Bloomberg invasion. But is it going to last? Absolutely. This has changed the nature, as you always point out, Michael, in the conversation in America. And it's spread from coast to coast, and that's not going to stop. This thing is going to deepen and broaden, regardless of not being able to sleep over in Zuccotti Park.
People really understand, I think, as you're pointing out, that 1% of the people control 40% of the wealth. They understand that. They didn't understand it before Occupied Wall Street, and they understand it now. And the country is behind understanding that and challenging it and having some kind of redistribution of that money. And that will not end with the physical loss of the space at Occupied Wall Street.
Redistribution of the money and privilege, but and redistribution of the power.
Right, it's money and power.
That's what the term horizontalism comes, that people shouldn't have power over you. It's not that there shouldn't be leaders or there shouldn't be programs and things we try to get, but people shouldn't have the kind of power that these particular other people have over us. It's going to develop even more deeply and broadly than it already has, and it's been at a lightning speed. You can't really predict where it's going to go and how fast it's going to go. It's in the nature of the phenomena. But you can, looking back, say, you know, that little red mole was burrowing underneath the surface all these years, and all of a sudden it burst out.
Let's put the bust into a little context about last Monday night. It wasn't the only bust that was going on in the last 2 weeks. And it looked to us from outside, well, why all of a sudden are there a half a dozen or a dozen busts of occupied Wall Street people all over the country? And it said, this can't be just chance.
Yeah.
And what have we found out, Michael?
Well, Mayor Kwan, the mayor of Oakland, let the cat out of the bag. She said that she was on a conference call of 18 mayors, and later it was learned that that conference call was organized by the Conference of American Mayors, and they discussed how to deal with the problem of this resurgent democracy that was budding up underneath their capitals. I would go one further, though, Michael, and I'd like your thoughts on this.
I do think that 18 mayors didn't get together on a conference call to decide to bust heads on occupied Wall Streets without the White House knowing about it and encouraging it or even setting it up. I don't know if there were probably Republican mayors in there, too, but we actually don't know which were the 18. But that was the evidence both Mayor Kwan in San Francisco as well as – or in Oakland – as well as what came out later, that there were two of those conference calls that indicates that this was a national bust of occupied Wall Street. I happened to be in coming back from Berlin late that night on Monday. You, for some reason, wound up down at occupied Wall Street, which is a few blocks from your house, on the night of the bust. And why don't you just tell us why you got there? I mean, maybe you were out for a late night walk with a dog you don't have, or maybe you needed a hot toddy or whatever they call them in England. But what were you doing out there, and what did you see?
Well, after you became addicted to a BlackBerry, I got addicted. I woke up at 3 in the morning, and my BlackBerry was next to my bed, so I turned it on to check my email. Dave McReynolds had sent out a email blast about what was going on. So I threw on my clothes and I walked over. I only live 3 blocks away from Zuccotti Park, Liberty Square. And I walked over to see what I could see and talk to who I could talk to and do what I could do. You know, I'm part of the National Lawyers Guild and I've been a part of the legal team down there. So I went over to see what was going on.
And when you got there, I mean, you go there a lot. I know you're there, you man the guild table. You've been one of the sources of a lot of information. You came in on the west side of the park. What did you come in on?
I came over from the Hudson River side.
Which is the west side.
Yeah, the west side. And the, you know, the park is one block square. But the cops, who were there by the hundreds and hundreds, had blocked off the park from a block away from the park. So you couldn't get near the place. They kept the media out. They had the place flooded in brilliant Klieg lights like it was a movie set. And when I got there, garbage trucks were rolling up. These are huge. They're bigger than two freight train cars. Huge garbage trucks were rolling up into the lights to collect the stuff and throw it out, with signs on the side of the garbage trucks saying, "Remember to clean up after your dog." Moreover, the cops had arrested about 1,000 people prior to the bust, so they had dossiers on at least 1,000 people. And they had informers inside of the park, so they knew precisely what they were doing. That place was covered like a military operation.
Yeah, the Times last Wednesday had an incredible picture of, you know, how they did it. It would look like one of those football diagrams when you're planning a play of where the arrows go and where the cops go and how they practiced on Randall's Island. And what's amazing to me, a lot of people had to know about this, that we somehow didn't know about it. I mean, I'm really surprised that it never leaked out to all of us in the National Lawyers Guild. I mean, we'd been preparing for, you know, almost 6 weeks, the lawsuits to try and save the park. And of course, last time on October 14th, which we've talked about in the show, we knew about it. 5,000 people came down there to stop the bust. We didn't need to go to court because we were pretty sure we'd stop it with all these people, or we hoped we would. And this time we had no notice at all, despite, Heidi, any thoughts about that?
I wanted to add that in addition to the practices that Michael just referenced, we know we know that the police in New York consulted with other police departments around the country and watched how they actually did their evictions. So I think what this speaks to is the fact that this is a larger coordinated effort. Just like we see at RNC and DNC, we have different layers of government, different levels talking and coordinating around the country.
We're glad you're bringing that out, because just before you stepped in, and Heidi was a bit late for the show due to being such a popular figure on national radio, but Heidi, we were talking about the fact that the mayor of Oakland had the call with 18 other mayors, and that there were two calls, and that the busts were coordinated on that level. But what you're saying is they're not just coordinated on that level, they're coordinated on the actual implementation of the busts.
I think so.
2 points. One is, since 9/11 especially, the police forces the country have been militarized, both in their intelligence and in their equipment. I mean, the one in New York City has a submarine. This is like an army going into Afghanistan. And second, they had planned for this. You know, they went in there under the pretext that the place was not sanitary. They knew that there was going to be a fight back. There was. It was marshaled by the attorneys from the National Lawyers Guild. They had prepared affidavits in advance to go into court against us when we tried to get this whole operation ruled illegal and overthrown. So they had prepared for this both militarily and legally.
And in a third way, Michael, they prepared by not allowing members of the press to cover it. That is what has provoked such outrage around the country. Images of violent police in Oakland, in other jurisdictions, the pepper spraying incident in New York, but they had that base covered by precluding journalists from taking photos.
Yeah, it's like, remember they invented the thing embedded journalism, and they wouldn't let journalists cover the war front like before.
And they did that at the Miami FTAA demos, too.
Yeah. It's amazing now. They assert that it's too dangerous for journalists to cover these busts. Journalists actually do go to the war front.
Right.
I mean, they're
right.
Like in foxholes all over the place. And, you know, they're having bullets like over their heads and they're getting killed more than occasionally. And they can't cover a bust that occupied Wall Street?
Well.
Remarkable.
It's clear to us that they want to find an off switch for this. But they don't understand social movements. This is not a riot. This is a huge uprising of people with shared grievances about political and economic situation of our country and the world. And I think that's going to catch them by surprise.
It already has.
Right. I think that's completely right. You can try and destroy the physical place, but you're not going to destroy the movement. On this show, we've often pointed fingers at the United States and NATO for going into Libya and overthrowing the government. We always suspected and was our belief that this was not done for reasons of human rights. And certainly to the extent they argued that there were human rights violations in the beginning, by the end, it seemed that it was NATO creating a lot more human rights violations. And you heard almost nothing about the oil industry during the war. It was poo-pooed all the time. Oh, don't worry. Don't make a big deal out of oil. It's not so important. It's not the reason we're going in. And now, of course, the Western oil companies are scrambling to control the oil of Libya, and particularly, I think, to keep China out of there, which was probably one of the reasons for them going in. So in reading the New York Times on last Wednesday, I come across a big article called Spared in War, Libya's Oil Flow is Surging Back. There's pictures of the pumps and all that kind of stuff that they use to get oil. And then there's this amazing sentence in the New York Times. You would have never seen this during the war. I want to repeat. You would have never seen this during the war. Here it goes. Quote, with proven reserves of 46.4 billion barrels, the largest in Africa, Libya is a great prize. Now, I ask our listeners, why didn't we see that quote during the war or before the buildup to the war? As we say in law, we have a Latin expression, res ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for itself. Libya is the great prize. Biggest oil reserves in Africa.
I want to announce to our listeners that the book that you, Michael Ratner, and I, Michael Smith, have been working on for 3 years has finally hit the streets. You can get it at orbooks, orbooks.com. It's called Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. Michael, if it wasn't for you, we would have never done this book. You got the documents. We've got the smoking guns. You can get it at or books, orbooks.com. It's called Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. Last Tuesday at 1 a.m., teams of New York City police in full riot gear descended upon the protesters at Liberty Square, home of Occupied Wall Street. 200 people were arrested as the police and bulldozers tore down tents, confiscated gear, clothing, computers, and the 5,000-volume library that had been assembled. The massive evictions are one of many reported across the country in an obviously nationally coordinated effort. We speak today and get a legal update from National Lawyers Guild attorney Danny Alterman, who helped win a last-minute temporary restraining order against the police evictions. Later that day, the victory was reversed by a Supreme Court judge in New York City.
Welcome, Danny, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, how are you?
We're great. As one of the attorneys working on the legal defense of Occupy Wall Street, when did you first hear about the raid?
I heard about it shortly after it happened, around 2 a.m. last week, of the day that we went into court. So I guess the 15th of November.
So what does a lawyer do when he's laying in bed and hears about a bad thing like this?
First he rubs the sleep out of his eyes, and then he says, do I have to? And then I put my pants on one leg at a time and got ready to rock and roll.
Danny, that's an exact description of how every lawyer feels at 2 in the morning. Do I really have to do this?
Yeah.
Do I really want to get up? Isn't there Alterman around to like do this and I can go back to sleep? That's what I felt when someone called me. Like,
but then,
right around
then the moral imperative sets in.
Well, I had your back on this one, Michael.
You certainly did.
So what'd you do? And
well,
what'd you want to accomplish?
I called in. The phone bank was called, and I called in a conference number.
The phone bank for the National Lawyers Guild group on this, right?
That's right. There's been a core group of 20 or 30 people working on issues that affect the occupiers down on Wall Street, and we had a phone bank, and I was called, and organically it was caused by who was willing to get up and who was willing to go and do the thing that needed to be done, which was to challenge the police action by Mayor Bloomberg and Commissioner Kelly.
Where'd you go, and what did you cook up, and what was the challenge? Why'd you say that this isn't legal?
Well, we talked strategy. We talked creating a document that would decide and get us into court in the morning. We discussed how and under what circumstances we would be able to find a judge that might be willing to get out of bed with us in the early morning hours, because we thought that the actions of the state was so oppressive and so contrary to having a free and transparent debate on the issue that we decided to go into court. So about four or five of us got together, and we followed the procedures that we needed to follow with regard to presenting an emergency orders to the court, and then arranged to meet Judge Lucy Billings at 6 a.m. With a set of papers, and we put together a set of papers in about 3 hours' time. And I got two of the lawyers in my car, and we went up to meet the judge, and one of the other lawyers joined us while we opened this coffee shop at 6 a.m.
So you met the judge at the coffee shop. What are the papers' requests? What did you want the judge to do?
Well, we wanted the judge to issue a temporary restraining order, which in legal terms means that the police could not continue to evict people from Liberty Park, and could not also then order them to be able to go back into Liberty Park with the belongings or the accoutrements of tents or tarps or whatever was keeping them warm in this, you know, in the early November days.
Danny, you got a good decision in this.
We got a great decision at first.
But did the police let the protesters go back in?
No. One of the most dramatic and newsworthy as well as historical precedent that happens in actions where there is extreme police action, and it is political, played out on the streets of Lower Broadway that morning. We got a signed order from the judge ordering them to let our clients go back in. We served Brookfield, which is the owner of the park, the city of New York through the Corporation Council and the police department by fax with a copy of the order, and called them, and then came down to and bought an index number and filed the lawsuit, which is an administrative thing that you have to do before it has the force of law, and then went into the area surrounding Occupy Wall Street on Liberty Park, and it was closed down.
This was despite a court order saying you had a right to go in there, that the protesters had a right to go back. Is that right?
Absolutely. And what this reminded me of was what had happened precisely in 1971 at the Attica, when the Attica massacre happened, when we got a court order to go in because people were dying and getting shot inside, and prison authorities refused to open up the prison to medics and to lawyers, causing the death of other people. So we went down there and we said, we have this court order, and we found the highest-ranking police officer, the chief of patrol. His name is Esposito. He's a very well-known and visible guy. And we attempted to serve him with it, and he says, I can't accept it. I'm not a lawyer, or I got to talk to my lawyer. So the mood was getting a little dark there because they were riot police, and they were all tense. And we were trying to consult with and have someone that would take responsibility for the order that we got. And no one would do that. And they kept on telling us to move. And finally, I said to one guy who was sort of getting on me and getting on another lawyer that was there, I said, listen, this reminds me of D. Yard at Attica. And he said, well, I've never been to Attica. And I said, well, we can make those arrangements if you want. And we finally basically gave up and said, well, look, you know, you realize you're violating a court order. You're theoretically in contempt of court. And I don't know what they told us is that Mayor Bloomberg, in the course of us getting an order and finding out about it, had decided to close the park, which was the complete opposite of what the order said, which was designed to reopen the park. And
it's amazing. It was a court order. The mayor apparently went on radio or TV at 8 a.m. and said, well, I was going to open the park, except now they have a court order, and I'm not going to open it.
Yeah,
the court order said you have to open it.
Like catch 22.
It was like amazing. Now, I have just a little part, and then I want to go back to where you were, Danny, because I was up at 6th Avenue and Canal.
Right.
And that's where a lot of the Zuccotti protesters had gone. And all of the lawyers like you were downtown trying to serve the order and at the square and trying to make sure the park was reopened. I went up with a couple of other law students or whatever to give a talk to the people who were there and to try and explain the court order, to tell people that under the court order, you have the absolute right to go back into that park and bring your tents. And there were about 400 people. And, of course, I was told to say, and I agreed with saying it, of course, that there's a good chance that despite a court order, the cops aren't going to let you back in. Now, that's a violation of the order, but you have to don't expect, even though we have a court order, which is the highest authority at that point you can have in the country to do something, don't expect it. And then what we did, and you were still, I guess, down in the park, although I don't know if I saw you down there, we then marched down from 6th Avenue and Canal to the park, where what we saw was, as you described, and you can describe it more, probably thousands of cops, not just hundreds, and all the way lining the 6th Avenue going down or Barrack Street going down, including cars from Homeland Security. Then we get to the park. Then back to your story, Danny. Would they let us in?
No, they wouldn't let us in. And Homeland Security is definitely there. You could see by the crew cuts in the shoes that they were there. And the park had been cleaned so that they had finished the cleaning. So there was really no excuse for it other than seemingly to penalize the protesters and the occupiers that we had gotten a court order. As you were coming down, I had to get ready to be prepared to argue the case.
Explain that. You had a court order, but there was a second phase that had to be argued. Your court order was only good for a certain amount of time.
In some ways, and we'll get back to this in a second, I think everyone, this whole process, regardless of the outcome, energized the demonstrations and energized the workers, the occupiers, and frankly, I think gave us a lot more ammunition to analyze because the city was ready. There was a temporary restraining order issued at 6:30 a.m.
That's the one you got from Judge Billings.
Got that from Judge Billings. We knew that Judge Billings may not be the judge that would hear the case because it would go into what lawyers call the wheel, what other people call get me a good judge that won't support the demonstrators from the court administration. But whatever it was, we didn't necessarily think that Judge Billings would stay on the case. She did not. We went back at 11:30 and then had, once a judge was assigned, had about a two-hour argument through lunch and through 2 o'clock when the judge, at that time, Michael Stallman, had heard argument and then took a couple of hours for him to write his opinion. And then he wrote his opinion.
He's a Supreme Court judge.
That presides in a part called the Transit Authority Park that essentially does transit authority cases, but is an all-purpose Supreme Court judge and has been so for many years.
And we should point out the Supreme Court in New York, as opposed to most other places, is the Court of General Jurisdiction.
Right.
If you want to go to the highest court, it's called the Court of Appeals. But so we're in the place where we should be.
We're in the place that we should be, and it's the Court of Original Jurisdiction for disputes such as these, and has the plenary power of. But it's a lower court. But this was only a temporary measure. So in a sense, they were ready for it. Judge Stallman received papers, and we received papers as we walked into court from the city. Which contained an affidavit, which is a legal document swearing to issues that involve public safety, health issues, other kinds of issues, that was clearly prepared before they evicted the protesters the 10 hours before. What this means is that the city knew, in preparing these papers, that there was going to be a legal challenge. Now we have a real opportunity not only to regenerate the thing, but also we know exactly what they're going to say.
Danny, but the judge actually ruled against the protesters.
The judge ruled against the protesters.
Let's talk about the reasons why. We've all read the decision.
Right.
He makes a big deal about sanitation, and he says that Brookfield Properties, this billionaire real estate firm...
From U.S. Steel, by the way.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But they own the World Financial Center. I mean, this is one of the biggest real estate...
This is not a fly-by-night. This is direct descendant from U.S. Steel.
Brookfield Properties got to build a skyscraper right across the street from this park. They make these rules. After we all occupy the place, they come up with these rules. One of the rules says you can't stay overnight, you can't sleep on the ground, you can't put up a tent. The decision, as I read it, says two things. One says you got to abide by these after-the-fact rules, and secondly, the place was unsanitary, and we're worried about the health and safety of the public, so therefore we got to close it down. You think that's a pretext?
I think it's absolutely a pretext. A couple of reasons. One is I've been volunteering for the last couple of months as a lawyer down there for the National Lawyers Guild, giving information to people that have been arrested and people that have legal questions. There's no health issues that are readily apparent, and the only issues that existed were issues on the day they evicted the people. Last week, the 15th, they issued two fire department regulations, which were not even summonses. They were, if you don't correct these conditions, you get a summons. That's number one. Number two is there was no apparent health issues. There was an issue regarding generators that was seized a few weeks ago. They were given back or they were confiscated. In terms of a pretext, absolutely a pretext that the mayor wanted to go in. And my suggestion, what my thoughts about it was, is that the demonstration that then happened a couple of days after the 15th was the reason why they wanted to go in and discredit the protesters.
Danny, we see this all across the country where local governments will enact a law forbidding some kind of protest-related activity after it's begun. And when we challenge these in court, they're always found to be unconstitutional. Will there be a challenge to these park-related regulations?
I don't know what exactly is going to be done in our particular case. I can tell you this. We may be looking at 21st century speech assembly petitioning in terms of a different perspective than where we've approached it before. It clearly is speech. We are clearly in the 21st century, and maybe we'll move to extend the kind of speech that is protected, and maybe that will include the speech that the people at Wall Street and the occupation being the kind of symbolic and actual protest where speech is protected.
Danny, let's talk about that for one second, because
what
you're talking about is expressive protest, and of course, you and I being long movement people, you know, when people used to wear black armbands against the Vietnam War, when they burned flags, they're not pure speech. They're not like you and I talking right now. Those are already protected. And we know that we achieved, even in New York, the right to sleep on the sidewalks a few years ago. And then this is a further extension of expressive protest. And in that light, one of the things, and I know you argued this case, and you got a pretty amazing line in the judge's opinion that indicates to me that what the people at Occupy Wall Street were doing was clearly protected by the Constitution and the First Amendment. The judge essentially
acknowledges the importance of their message, because what he says, and I know you're familiar with this line, Occupy Wall Street brought attention to the increasing disparity of wealth and power in the United States, largely because of the unorthodox tactic of occupying the subject public space on a 24-hour basis and constructing an encampment there. So what's he saying there, Danny? He's saying what?
He's saying that is a form of protected speech. That is the message that's going out to the, which resonates with the public all around the country, because obviously we believe, because the protesters believe, and 80% of the country believes, that the system is broken, okay, and that people are being unable to function in the system where they were able to function before, because the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and the middle class is getting more strung out.
Despite that finding, which is to say that an unorthodox occupation brought a message of a disparity of power and wealth, he somehow finds against us.
Right. I want to just stress for the audience that the deal with what happened last week was they came in with photographs, they came in with allegations that there were health hazards, they came in with the fact that Brookfield may have liability for any accidents that happened in there. They came in with all this information because they knew they were going to be challenged. We didn't have a chance to respond on papers. We didn't have photographs. We didn't have narratives. And the next time we go to court, we will. And now we'll be able to develop this and take this argument a little further and a little harder and a little more cogently. In some ways, I agree. I think he did us a favor. I think he's going to allow us to make a stronger record. And I can tell you this, the day after the court press, last week, the Occupied Wall Street Financial Committee reported that they raised more money just by people on the street giving volunteers than they ever have in any day or any week in the past. And what does that say? The common people, the people that are watching this and going to work every day, trying to make ends meet, trying to pay for education, medical costs, all that stuff, that stuff is resonating, and the people are supporting, you know, the occupiers and supporting the idea that a new form of protest and speech is coming around. And that's what's the most encouraging. It's a privilege and an honor to represent these people. I think the people have the pulse of the country, and it's happening.
It's pretty exciting, Danny, isn't it?
It is exciting. It's exciting and exciting, and that makes you get out of bed, Michael.
Well, I was going to just thank you, Danny, for being there from the very beginning of the Lawyers Guild group that's been working on this, but particularly for getting out of bed at 2 a.m. I mean, amazing, the first victory, but even as you went on, it was, as I agree, it was really made people feel really strong yesterday.
Look at it like this, Michael. If people didn't wear the black armbands, or if people didn't get arrested for burning the flags in the 60s, or if people didn't get thrown out of the Olympics for doing the black power handshake, how would our society change? It doesn't change because you ask it to change. It changes through political protest and speech, and we may be, I don't know if we are, but we may be experiencing that very thing, and we're in the middle of it. And when we're in the middle of it, take up the fight and be prepared to lose and be prepared to confront the contradictions. Get up in the middle of the night and do a thing. And for Mayor Bloomberg and Commissioner Ray Telly, I just want to give him a little Bob Dylan, which says, pick up your money, pack up your tent, because you're not going anywhere.
Danny nice. Altman from the National Lawyers Guild, thank you so much for being on
Thanks, Danny.
Okay.
Bye, Danny.
Get some sleep.
Peace.
Bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Clouds won't swift, rain won't lift, gate won't close, ratings froze. Get your mind off winter time, you ain't going nowhere. How many letters they sent. Morning came and morning went. Pick up your money and pack up your tent. you ain't going nowhere.
Millions around the country continue to stand in solidarity with the Occupy Wall Street movement. The movement defends the 99% of Americans against the wealthiest 1% who control most of the wealth and the political discourse and political parties in the United States. Meanwhile, U.S. long-term unemployment, approaching 20%, is taking a heavy toll socially. Social costs are high, the stress, the tension, the anxiety within families, health, people's welfare are all suffering terribly. We discuss these topics with returning guest, economics professor Richard Wolff, who says enormous wealth could be produced right now with the unused tools, factories, and raw materials that have been idled by the current crisis of capitalism. You could put that together with the nation's under and unemployed people, and we could rebuild our cities and infrastructure. We also update on the capitalist crisis in Greece and in Europe. Professor Richard Wolff, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you've become a star in the last year. We would like to take credit for putting you on when you were not an unknown, because you were always, you know, we're head of the economics department at the University of Massachusetts, et cetera, famous author. But your radio career really started a little bit right here. And now, of course, between the you were always sat here waiting for the economic crisis to hit here.
Yes.
You'd say, Michael, I just came back. There's eight unions together in France. What's happening in England? What's happening in Greece? Well, here you are, Rick Wolff.
You always would make the joke that the Marxists have predicted five out of the last two economic crises. But this one certainly is here, and I wanted to ask you about it because people, I think, are a little confused, and they think, well, it's a crisis of debt. There's all this debt out there. There's student debt in America. There's the Greek government's debt. There's all this debt. And it's really not a crisis of debt, is it? It's really a crisis of capitalism. I'd like you to explain that.
Debt is always a sign of something else. Most people don't need a lesson to be told it's better not to have debts than to have them. And it's true for governments and it's true for businesses. You go into debt because you see either a need or an opportunity for which you don't have the money. And so you either forgo the need or you forgo the opportunity or you borrow. And if you see off-the-chart increases in debt, as we do in the case of individuals over the last 30 years, in the case of corporations, particularly also over the last 30 years, and in the case of governments at a slow rate over the last 30 years and at an astronomical rate over the last three or four, then you have to ask the question, why? And that's where the focus on debt falls apart, because looking at a debt doesn't explain to you why the debt is what it is.
Let me just say on that, because I think it's important, and that's why we're in this subject. People blame Greece because they spent too much money, supposedly, and got wound up in debt. They blame the American homeowner because they spent too much money on mortgages and all this kind of stuff for their houses, and they blame them for that. They blame Italy for going into debt. So what you're really saying is debt is a symptom, and we shouldn't be so quick to blame. I think that's where you're going to come out, the so-called debtor.
Right. I think that you have to look at the explanation. For example, here in the United States, it's very clear why Americans went into debt starting 30 years ago. The wages that had been rising in the United States for the previous 150 years, giving all Americans the idea that each generation lives better than the one before, that it's worth it to be an immigrant from far away to come here because you'll have a better life, all of that had been built into the American psyche, into the American assumption about what it means to be an American. You promise your children a better life. They will go to schools you couldn't go to. They will have a house and that you couldn't afford, and so on. So 1970s come along, and that period of 150 years of rising wages is over. It's over because the computer replaces large numbers of people. They don't need to be hired. Corporations are making decisions to move production out of the United States to other countries where the wages are lower. Immigrants are flowing into the United States because the uneven development of the world economy makes them poorer and the United States look more attractive. Millions of women discover women's liberation, don't want to stay at home all their lives, and go out looking for jobs. You put that together, the supply of labor, women and immigrants going up, the demand for laborers because of the technology of the computer and export of jobs going down. And suddenly employers have the greatest of all possibilities. They don't have to raise wages anymore. The long labor shortage in America of 150 years since our inception is over. They now have more workers than they need. And they can say to each worker, they don't even have to say it, if you're not happy here, there's a lot of other people that will be, so you better take no wage increase. Meanwhile, you're drumming into the American people this notion that everybody lives better. You should have more. All the advertisers are telling you to be a real American, you should drive a nice car, shouldn't be more than 4 years old, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you put the American people in an impossible situation. Wages aren't going up anymore, so you really have to forget about that rising consumption and tell your children they're not going to have a better life. They'll be lucky to have what you have. We didn't have that leadership. Nobody had that conversation. No politician wanted to be the bearer of that bad news. Moreover, the business community didn't want it, because if you had to tell people that the days of rising wages are over, you might institute among workers a desire to do something about that situation. All of those things came together, so there was nothing said. So what did American individual workers do? Two things. Right? One, they did more work. If your wage per hour doesn't go up, do more hours. So that we are now the country in which workers work more hours of paid labor per year than any other advanced industrial country. Our workers are exhausted. But here, to get to Michael's question, the other thing the American working class did is the only thing you can do if you want to deliver the American dream to your children and your wages can't afford it. You borrow money. And as if that wasn't enough, now let's look at the other side of the equation. Whenever there's a debt, they're not just a borrower, there's a lender. This is a kind of strange game to blame the borrower. That's like blaming one side of a partnership as if the other one had nothing to do with it. Every bank in America went to work in the 1970s to pump credit into the hands of people. And they did that because they saw a fantastic opportunity, a working class that wanted to deliver the American dream to itself and its children, unable to do so except by borrowing. Great, thought the bankers. Here's a captive audience. Let's flood them with ways of borrowing. People don't remember. In the 1970s, the only people early in the 70s who had a credit card were businessmen with an American Express card. Suddenly, we made credit cards available, MasterCard and Visa, to everybody. That's just a way of pumping money, debt, into the population. Some of you may remember, then and now, getting unsolicited credit card offers in the mail every day, money being spent to pump debt into you. So sure, the people who borrowed in some abstract way, maybe you shouldn't. And maybe the banks shouldn't have pumped credit, shouldn't have given people misleading idea of what credit was and how you build up. You know, you notice how a credit card debt monthly statement is sent to you. You're told your debt is $1,682. But all you have to send us this month to keep us happy is $18.46. Right. Oh, great, say people. That I can afford. And they write their little check for $18, not understanding that the rest of it is now going to start accruing interest charges.
At high interest.
At very high interest. The current average interest rate of credit cards is in the neighborhood of 18%. Banks are borrowing that money from the Federal Reserve at under 1%. And lending it at 18%. Nice business for them. That's why they always push credit. But to blame the borrower as if the lender is an innocent in this partnership is bizarre.
Let me move you for a second, though. We understand the debt here. I want to move you to the – you've explained that pretty well in the United States, very well. What about Greece?
It's basically the same problem. You bring Greece into the European Union. And now you have a situation that invites all kinds of corporations to make a decision. Once upon a time, in order to serve the Greek market, they had to be active inside Greece. Otherwise, people would not think of it as an appropriate thing to buy. There was a certain nationalism, as there is in our own country, to buy American or buy Greek. When you collapse all the countries together, when the Greek drachma, their old currency, disappears to be replaced by the euro, as happened in other countries, all kinds of business decisions became different. There were no border. You could not have a tariff the way you had before. Greece was able to protect itself, for example, from exports from Germany by having a protective wall so they could build up Greek industries until they were big enough and efficient enough to compete with the Germans. This is exactly what the United States did when it was in the situation where it needed it, and many other countries. But once you have a uniform currency, you can't do that. It's like Tennessee erecting a tariff against products from Kentucky. That's not legal. It can't do that. Once you had a European Union, once you had a common currency, basically with the new millennium around 2000, the Greeks suddenly discovered that there was no reason for a German company that had a subsidiary in Greece to stay there. They would just as soon close the plant, go back to Germany. They prefer to hire German workers for all kinds of reasons. The technology is German. The training that is needed is done in German. It's much more expensive to do that for Greek workers. There are a thousand reasons why you had the result that we now see, and we should have foreseen, that with a common market, there was an agglomeration, a concentration of production and the wealth that goes with that in some countries, and its destruction in other countries. Okay, that could have been handled. It should have been handled. It's like, okay, we didn't foresee this. Let's see now. We're going to take some of the profits being earned in Germany and use them, raise the taxes, and use them to develop new industrial mechanisms that take advantage of Greece's better climate, Greece's ability to produce agricultural stuff, Greece's technical expertise in olives and wine and a whole bunch of things that they're good at. And then you could have offset that. If you don't do that, you create an impossible disparity. You're creating parts of Europe that are desperately poor, and they're not going to have the same needs or demands of the common union, and that's going to blow up in your face. And that's why the Greeks are in the situation
they had to borrow to do that, because once they start getting poorer and poorer after the EU is set up,
they couldn't function without borrowing. And let me remind you,
the banks gave it to them.
Yeah. Who lent to the Greek government? Above all, the French and German banks. So it's the banks who were making money because of the concentration of production in their country who had the wealth with which they then came to the poor countries and said, hey, we got a lot of money. You've got a lot of need. The Greek politician wants to provide to his people what they had promised them would be the benefit of joining the European Union. Well, the only way to do that was to lend them money. So the banks made a lot of money. Let's remember, the Greek people have been paying taxes to pay interest on the debt, so that a lot of money has been made off Greek debt. It's not just some gift to the folks in Greece. It's a big payoff. Part of the wealth of Germany and France and their economic success is their ability to have really gotten huge inflows of interest from their loans to the poor countries. As usual, it's a partnership. And deciding that it's all the fault of the Greeks, as if the European, the French and German banks didn't make a fortune off of this, is just a hustle on the part of the politicians there. See, the great fear in Europe is a generalized collapse. And by the way, the debt, the interest payments that the Italians now have to pay on their debt cross 7%. The general view in Europe is if it crosses 6%, you're finished. So Italy is now where Greece was approximately 6 to 8 months ago. And that's on a very, very dangerous place. So let me just finish. The debt of Italy is 4 to 5 times the debt of Greece. You're not talking about a little poor country. You're talking, Italy is the 8th largest economy on this planet. They have over $2 trillion of debt outstanding. If they cannot pay, and that's where it's going, you're going to see a level of repercussions inside Italy as the struggle there. Berlusconi, in stepping aside, said that he's only going to step aside, which he promised to do, if an austerity program is pushed in, changing labor rules, that means lower wages, cutting back government jobs, that means more unemployment, and cutting back government services. You know, we may see a resurgence of the Italian left, the likes of which nobody has seen before, since it's there, it's been there a long time. But the whole European Union is being ripped apart. They've had a crisis like we have for 4.5 years. They've watched a recovery program that spent huge amounts of money bailing out banks, insurance companies, large corporations, and their stock markets. They've seen that not work. And now they're looking at government saying, well, we did this big recovery problem and we borrowed a lot of money to do it. By the way, no one is shaking the finger at the American government, the French government, the German government. They borrowed trillions. Where's the big criticism of their debt? They borrowed trillions for a recovery program that failed. You ought to have some criticism there. Now the mass of people are being told all over Europe, you have to suffer an austerity to raise the money to pay off the loans that we took out for a recovery program that you didn't benefit from. Of course there's general strikes everywhere. Of course Italy is falling
in Greece.
Apart.
Professor Richard Wolff, this is what everybody's worried about in America. How does the capitalist crisis in Greece, the capitalist crisis in Italy, how does that interact with the crisis here in the United States? What are your predictions?
The only thing it can do is to make it worse here. There's no other outcome. We sell a very important part of our output in this country to Europeans. We buy crucial inputs to our economy from Europe. We invest more in Europe, in investing our capital as Americans, than we do anywhere else in the world, and vice versa. Every one of those crucial economic linkages between our two economies is going to be negatively impacted by this crisis. I suppose if you were looking for some way out, it's going to hamper the ability of European companies to compete with those in the United States. That's going to lead them to try to squeeze out a better deal from their own workers, which is going to exacerbate tension there. If they're successful, it's going to be problems for the United States. You may see,
because if they're successful, they'll be able to produce
their
products cheaper in Europe, and they'll be able to sell to sell worldwide and even here.
That's right. And so suddenly the Volkswagen is going to be cheaper and it's going to outcompete the Chevy or the Ford, et cetera, et cetera.
You think the Jetta also will be cheaper, Volkswagen Jetta?
Yeah. It's
a good car. What do you put forward? Not a capitalist solution, because we know what the capitalist solution is. It's to make people poorer and put the whole thing on their backs. What are the demands that socialists would raise, both in the United States and in Europe?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that that's now a very hot question, and it hasn't been a hot question for a long time, so I think it's real progress that it's a hot question. There are those who don't want to go very far out of anxiety or fear or their own view, and they just want something which really isn't a socialist program, although a lot of people think it is. I would call it a Rooseveltian New Deal-y kind of thing. They want the government to step in and really fix this properly, not a trickle-down, help-the-top program. We just had that. That didn't work. But what you might call a trickle up from below, a big program of government building, government employment. In Europe, that's being demanded. Some people like to mix it with their environmental concerns and refer to a Green New Deal and things like that. So the idea here is come in, learn. That's what Roosevelt did. And even if it isn't going to solve the problem, it's a lot better way to go than what we've done. And so that may be the next step. I think a lot of people will refer to that as a socialist step, even people who call themselves socialists, because that's what they did in the 1930s. But it really isn't socialism. It doesn't get moved to a different economic system. It's a way of fixing or trying to fix the existing system. It'll take longer, and I can see that already in the Occupy Wall Street movement where I go and speak. It'll take longer for people, and that's normal and natural, to come to the conclusion that fixing this system won't be enough, or that fixing this system isn't an adequate response, and to begin to ask themselves what an alternative system. And there's a lot of obstacles in the way. It's not just the hesitance to go there because it's been a taboo in American culture and even in large parts of Europe, despite the fact that they have socialist and communist parties there. It's not just the taboo. It's also the absence of a new model. The reputation of the Soviet Union and China, for better or worse, is not functioning as a model. Too many things that happen there are perceived by people on Wall Street too, the demonstrators, as not where they want to go, not what they want to do. And they're pretty clear about that. And even those that are critical of capitalism don't know what the alternative is or would be that they can focus then, even if they're willing to think in terms of a new system. And if I had to point to anything that socialists and Marxists and communists today might want to think about and do in their thinking, it would be to be self-critical about the past experiences with socialism and communism, honestly, and to come up with a new alternative, call it by the same name, call it by a new name. That doesn't really matter so much. But to come up with something that can be a credible alternative in the minds of people that might give us a chance to get out of this crisis without having to experience in this country the obvious suffering that is happening in Greece and that is about to descend on Italy.
What kind of demands would you put on the government now? Immediate demands, demands that would lead in a socialist direction, demands for kind of democratic demands.
Good.
What kind of demands would you make?
I try to mix the two together.
Stiegel coming back. I mean,
I want to combine them because I think that's the best thing we can do. I would demand now an immediate government employment program, a commitment by the United States government to say honestly, as Roosevelt did in 1933 and 4, if the private sector either cannot or will not provide jobs to millions of Americans who need and want them, then there is no alternative but for the government to do it. That's what happened between 34 and 41. Roosevelt created and filled 11 million jobs. If you adjust that number for the increase in population,
20 million.
It would be at least 20 to 25
million. I heard you speak before.
Yes, that's right. So I would demand that. But
job creation, what else?
But in a radically new way, this would not be a program of the sort Roosevelt had, in which the government sets up big companies, that public companies that hire workers. No, here's the new thing. We need to give a new direction to the American economy so that we don't repeat these crises anymore. We allow in the United States an employer to fire, to deprive some people of an entire job while other people keep their job. The alternative is obviously everybody works an hour less. Everybody works 2 hours less. Or as you put it, we kind of have a general rule that amounts to a sharing of the unemployment. If we say that kind of thing, then we don't have to fire anybody because everybody takes a bit of a hit. I understand that, and unions like it often because it creates a solidarity. It doesn't pit the few who hold on to their job against those who have lost everything. But I think the better question is the basic question. It is irrational of any economic system to have, as we do in the United States today, 20 to 25 million unemployed people, side by side with roughly 30% of our productive capacity unused, store space, factory space, machines, equipment, and computers. We have the people who want the work. We have the raw materials and the equipment for them to use. The output would be a vast wealth with which we could solve our social problems. We live in a capitalist system that cannot put these three together, cannot take the people who want the work, put it together with the equipment they need to produce the output we desperately require. That's a grade of F for an economic system. And that's the biggest critique of capitalism I know to make. And boy, is it appropriate in the middle of a crisis when we can see it every day.
Well, Professor Richard Wolff, I think you've summed up the reason why Michael Ratner and I are socialists. We thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We want to invite you back for another discussion about how you get from where we are now to where we want to be.
Right,
and your website,
talk about,
Rick.
And
your website.
Please go anytime, rdwolf, spelled with two Fs, .com. Or tune in to my program weekly on WBAI every Saturday from noon to 1. It's called Economic Update, and I would welcome you to it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org and look for us on Facebook at Law and Disorder.